On this episode, we went to Ghana. For the past 2-3 years, the queer community in Ghana has been facing serious tension from the government as they move to criminalize homosexuality and queerness in general. On this episode, we have a first-hand experience of what it means to be a queer Ghanaian living in Ghana in 2023. I hope you learned something.
So I am now here with Kojun. Hi, Kojun.
Hi, good day. Trust you are well.
Yes, I am. Thank you. How are you doing today?
I'm great. Thank you for asking.
All right. Can you please introduce yourself?
Okay. Hi, I am Papa Kojo Ambofododo. I am based in Ghana. I am an activist and a researcher. I work with Rightify Ghana, and I also work with documenting queerness, documenting lives of queer people across Ghana.
Can you talk more about your work with Rightify Ghana and documenting experiences of queer people in Ghana?
Yes, sure. I work with Rightify Ghana as a project coordinator. I have been filling that capacity for, I think, the last two to three years. Mm-hmm. And basically the work that Rightify Ghana does is that we document queer people, right? So abuse most of the time of queer people, blackmail stories. And we also do a lot of media monitoring for queer news, anything LGBTQ related. That is basically the work of Rightify Ghana. In terms of documenting queerness, that is an idea that I think I developed and decided to pursue from the work that I do with Rightify. And it was like in an opposite direction of what I was doing at Rightify. And I decided that instead of documenting abuse, stories of abuse and the likes, I was rather going to concentrate on the other aspects of queerness, you know, like documenting queer marriages, documenting queer happiness, queer stories, mm-hmm. And the like. Yeah, so that's been for documenting queerness. It's a relatively younger project that I took on, and I started it. Yeah.
Okay. It's really interesting that you said take on a project that celebrates queer joy, which is actually what drew me to your work, basically. There's a series that you're running where you're taking pictures of people who are much, much older in the Ghanaian queer community. How is that going?
So far, so good. It's not just pictures, you know, it is more of the lived experiences and the stories that older queer people have. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that particular work kind of boils down from me and my own trauma around my queerness, because like of this whole idea that if you are a queer person, you are going to die soon and you know the likes. And also mm-hmm. the fact that queerness has been framed in Ghana and across Africa as something that was very recently imported, like, you know, mm-hmm. queerness, like 10, 20, 50 years ago, there wasn't anything like queer people. Mm. And so, like, it is just me trying to confront my own sense of trauma and also at the same time challenge something that has been spread by propagandists against the queer community. And so I go around, I look for queer elders that are mm-hmm. 60 years or and above, and I speak to them. I try to document their lives, and I used to write it on Twitter, but now I video them and then I post them on YouTube instead.
That sounds really interesting, because one, how do you even find these queer elders?
I think I get that question a lot. This is not the first time I'm hearing this. And I guess I just employ a lot of different ways. One of them is my Twitter calls. So once in a while, I post on Twitter that I am looking for queer elders to speak to. And I think through that, I have interviewed, those are the interviews that are actually even out. So the first time I put out the call, I connected to, I had like one person reaching out to me that her grand auntie is a trans woman and she's 83, you know, and I drove to all the way, I think about 18 hours from where she is to speak to her. And I think the second time too was on social media as well. Mm-hmm. And as for that, I had the 62-year-old gay man reach out to me himself to tell mm-hmm. me that, oh, he's 62 and mm-hmm. he's gay and he's in Ghana and he would love to speak to me. And mm-hmm. so we spoke, and I think his interview is on YouTube. Apart from that, I have a lot more queer elders that I have spoken to that I have been working on. For the most part of it, when you look at them, most of them, I'm able to get them because of, let me just say, being in touch with the community, right? Mm-hmm. And so by word of mouth, you tell this person, oh, hey, I am looking for a queer person that is older, and they will also tell another person. And just like that, you have so many recommendations coming in. Mm-hmm. Like as I speak now, I have about 6 elders that I have already spoken with, and I am still like editing and putting their interviews together.
Hmm. That's actually very interesting. And I wonder, how had these conversations been going? What's an overarching theme that you have noticed while talking to queer elders in the Ghanaian queer community?
I think for the most part of it, when you consider queerness and the lives of queer elders, are like 3 very dominant things that you see, right? So mm-hmm. usually I like to ask, when did you know you were queer and how was the environment when you were mm-hmm. queer? So mm-hmm. that is like me trying to put a context on the past and how queerness was constructed in Ghana in the past. And you find that in the past, being queer wasn't this much like hated, right? It just tells you that for so many of these elders, being queer was like just something that you didn't talk about. Even for those that knew and for those that were actively engaged in like homosexuality or lesbianism, mm-hmm. it was still something that wasn't discussed like that, right? And so it was like a very don't ask, don't tell situation back mm-hmm. then. It wasn't exactly accepted, but it also wasn't hated. There wasn't this much vitriol against it. Mm-hmm. And then you ask them, so currently, how is it like? And so like, current, they give you a current analysis and you know that with time, and I think maybe with the rise of religions and institutions and systemic homophobia, there's been a lot more vitriol directed against queerness, mm-hmm. you know. I think a third theme that like you see and it cuts across like almost every elder that I speak to is about isolation and how lonely it is to be a queer person and be old. Right. Mm-hmm. And so you have like a lot of these people having a lot of their support system unavailable because like once you are queer and you grow old, younger queer people don't want to be friends with you. And you also don't happen to know a lot of other queer people that are old like you. And so because of that, it is extremely isolating. And also there is the fact that obviously you don't even have family, because like if you are gay you cannot marry in Ghana, so mm-hmm. it's just you, and your family also have their own perceptions about you, and if you are not even privileged to have like economic empowerment, it's just going to be you. And so like I think a really huge third theme that I also notice is about the isolation and how lonely it is to be old and care.
That's something. And there was something you mentioned just now about how it wasn't always so frowned upon the way it is now, that everybody is basically attacking queer people and it's like this magical export that just came and, you know, is shocking everybody. And now everybody wants to be a part of it. And so homophobes are against it because it's, you know, it's corrupting Africans in quotes, but it's something that's always been there. I mean, look at the age of the people that you are talking to for your theory. Yeah, it's really interesting. So on that note, I want to talk about what's going on currently in Ghana's queer community. The last time I had this conversation, I'm pretty sure you know Shekia, right?
Yeah, Shekia that just passed away.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah, last time I had this conversation.
Rest in peace.
I know. Rest in peace. Last time I had this conversation was with her, and she really broke down the details. And honestly, I want us to do a 30-second pause for Shekia.
Sure.
Thank you. May her soul rest in peace.
Okay. May her soul rest in peace.
Yeah. Again, to the conversation, basically, just give me a brief of what's happening in Ghana's queer community at the moment. I know that, not sure where the law is at right now, but I know that there was a law that was being passed in conversation, basically. I'm not sure the legal terms to you. Oh, yeah.
So there is a law. It's not a law, it's a bill, because like it hasn't been officially signed and ratified. But there is a bill that is currently still in parliament that criminalizes queer people. And the reason that it gained so much attention was, now I don't know if it's still draconian, because like I read Uganda's new law and I was so shocked. So I don't know if like it's still draconian, but it is a law that did not only criminalize queerness, but it criminalized advocacy, including media. It criminalized sympathy, that if a queer person is being beaten and you are standing somewhere and tell them to stop, or you give the queer person a place to hide, you can go to prison for like 11 years. So there is a bill like that that is currently still in parliament that is being debated. I think there was, when the bill was being considered by the parliamentary legal committee, there was a lot of memos that was sent to parliament. I think Ratify Ghana sent a memo and we were invited. And still at the end, the parliamentary legal committee recommended for the bill to be passed. It hasn't been passed yet. The last I checked, I think a private citizen had sued the parliament, the speaker and the state for, you know, some of the provisions in that bill. So that is where the point is. Unfortunately, despite the fact that the bill hasn't been passed yet, there has still been a lot of implications on the community that are negative. And one of them has been how much it has empowered abusers, and it has empowered homophobic sentiments within people in Ghana. And so like you have a lot of cases these days on people that have been set up and beaten, people that have been thrown out of their houses. So many of them now, when you compare currently to like 3 or 4 years ago. So that has been the situation. The bill hasn't been passed, but despite that, there has still been like a series of negative effects on the community. And it is also projected and expected that this is most likely going to get worse if this bill is passed.
Are there like any, will I say, protective measures or any attempts? Basically, what is Ratify Ghana doing at the moment as regards?
So there's been a lot going on. And I think as a general criticism, before the bill, there wasn't like a lot of preparation, you know, for this. But the credit that I would give to organizations and Rightify Ghana is that post-bill, post-introduction of the bill, there has been a lot of coalitions that's been formed. There has been a lot of pushback from activists and activist organizations. For Rightify Ghana, I think one of the primary things that we are doing is we are doing a lot of media advocacy. So, for example, when this bill came out, a lot of Ghanaians thought that it was a bill that seeked to criminalize. I don't know how to frame it, because like they would usually say in Chi, right? Like in the local Ghanaian language. But a lot of Ghanaians did not know the details of the bill. Yes. And so people thought that it was to prevent queer people from getting married. And people also actually thought that it was like an opposite, you know, of what the bill was supposed to do. People thought it was like a homosexuality supporting bill, you know. And so, like, I think it was because, like, Rightify Ghana is, like, one of the only media organizations and the organization that is concentrated on media. It was up to us to, like, break the bill down into its various components. Like, so when you take this part of the bill, this is what it says. When you take this part of the bill, this is what it says. Apart from that, we have also been putting a lot of efforts into developing safety and security strategies currently for queer people and the queer community, just in case the bill is passed. So we have had a lot of engagements, we have had a lot of plans, and we have a lot of things that we are currently implementing in case this bill is passed and the rate of abuse increases and we need like immediate help, some strategies that we can just quickly follow. Yeah.
I'm sure you guys are doing amazing work and must be wounded what tedious, but it must take a lot of work to, you know, get to where you're going to. And I wish you all the best in your journey there. But I'm curious about how this bill impacts the personal work that you're doing in curating stories from queer elders.
Thank you. And I think this is a question that I have asked myself a lot. Constantly when I ask myself, I think I arrive at the same conclusion that my actual existence is criminalized. So even if I work or I don't, because I'm an intersex person and gender non-binary. So even if I continue doing this work or not, I am, you know, still supposed to be in prison, right?
Yeah.
But you are right. This bill criminalizes advocacy. It criminalizes talking about queer people. And that is basically like the central theme of the work that I do. And it's not just that. It's also, you know, about the security of the people that I am even meeting and interviewing. So then if like a bill like this is passed, then I have to ask myself, where am I going to meet with these people? Because like if I am traveling all the way to, like I'm driving 18 hours to a different region to speak to someone and the person is very visibly queer, where do I arrange to speak with this person, you know? Because like the mere fact that in the bill, one provision is that if you suspect someone is queer, you have to call the police. So this bill basically not only criminalizes the work, it also criminalizes me as a gender non-conforming, non-binary, an intersex person, like my entire existence as well.
No, it's just funny what you said about doing the work and being criminalized in the whole process. It's not like you're exempt yourself. Like, this also still affects you. And if not that it was life-threatening, all of it would be funny, actually. Because I did read the bill in detail. But you can tell that a lot of effort was put into this direction that you're choosing to go with the queer community. And I don't see that effort put into any other sector, basically. And it's not just in Ghana. Like, look at Uganda now. They've come up with their own. And Nigeria came up with their own years ago. And yeah, it's a general African thing.
Yeah, you are right about that, you know, and I think if I remember when this Uganda bill got posted, like I tweeted, the devil works hard, but whoever is trying to push like homophobia is working too hard, way too hard, you know, and I honestly wish that the same effort is put into education and policies, you know, poverty alleviation policies. But unfortunately, I think in international relations and in social science, you have like the idea of scapegoating. So if politicians want to detract anger from anything they pick, and it just goes to show how much wrong is going on in Ghana, how much wrong is going on in Nigeria, because like there are no jobs. It is not the fault of queer people that people don't have jobs. There isn't food, there is no money. But you find that one thing that unites everybody is homophobia. And so what is the best way to let this anger, what is the best way to let this like general frustration, the system, you know, calm down? Is this by deflecting this and putting it on queer people, you know? And so you find that there are a lot of propaganda, like queer people is the reason that the country is so poor, because we are spending a lot of money on HIV treatment program, which is not true, which is honestly not true. Which is not true. You which see, there is this there's this weird attempt and to forcefully contort and change research and data to just support the kind of like things that are in their heads. You know, all the things that they think about care, like queer people are wearing pampers, that say you are straight, why are you worrying about a man having anal sex? You know, there is all these like things that they say just to draw people's attention and put a lot more responsibility of their failures on queer people. So yeah, I mean, if we were to, I completely have a total disregard for African politics and politicians in general. And I am sorry if I went into that way too deep.
Honestly, it's something to actually talk about. Like, that's why I said it's something that could be funny if it wasn't life-threatening for all of us. Honestly, going into that is a whole different ballgame on its own. But yeah, what have you learned so far on your journey?
I think there has been a lot of personal reflections for me. As I stated earlier, prior to starting this series, I had my own set of like internalized trauma. And one of them primarily was me and how much I have been afraid of being queer. Because it just feels like you don't really see a lot of old people and that I was going to die. And so as much as possible, I've tried to live in the moment. And then I go out there and I meet people that are actually old, that are not dead, but are also queer. It just like really made me confront some of these things that society has told me, and the people that hate me but frame it as care have, you know, constantly told me that, hey, this is what you are doing, you will die early, and you know, those things. And of course, there is also always this sense of fulfillment that comes with queer people expressing how much happy they are when they read their stories, when they hear these interviews, you know. There's always like this sense of fulfillment, like, yeah, I am actually doing this. This is something that I have always wanted to do. And like people also are interested in it. So, yeah.
I'm glad that you're doing such fulfilling work, if not for anybody but for yourself at the end of the day. And it's like honestly heartwarming and wholesome to watch. So thank you.
Absolutely, absolutely. You're...
So we've come to the end of our conversation. I'm wondering if you have any parting notes just before we go.
I just want to let any queer person that listens to this know that I affirm them. Queerness has always been in Ghana, queerness has always been in Africa. So like, I think one of my first videos, I did a history of queerness within Ghana. Mm-hmm. And like, what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to do one within like Africa, you know, to just to show that even before colonialism, even before like religion and Christianity came to Ghana, queer people lived in Ghana, queer people lived in Africa. And we are going to continue to be here. They can try, but they cannot completely succeed. They can try their best. They cannot succeed. We should try to be resilient, build safety nets, and, you know, be proud of ourselves in our queerness. And together, we can build something.
Yeah, that feels so wholesome, honestly. We should keep together and keep the community going strong, and not just within Ghana. I mean the African queer community in general.
Absolutely.
We can only move forward by sticking together. There's a saying of human rights violations like jollof rice, and it will go round.
Yeah, it will go round. It goes round and round.
That's right. And the only way we can challenge that is by sticking together. But yeah, this was a lovely, lovely chat. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me. I have had a good time. Thank you as well.
So that was Kojo and Situation of Things in Ghana. We as queer Africans should do the work to connect to our Ghanaian queer siblings and find out how we can support them. I'm also very interested in the work Kojo is doing to curate queer Ghanaian elders. It makes me really excited for the future. And on that note, I can't wait for you to listen to the next episode.